Mr. Wimmer.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Deano. Suppose I live on the same block as the mayor of my village, and prior to an election, I put up a sign in my yard that says, "Mayor so-and-so is the village idiot." Can the government ban the display of that sign based on the theory that the language on the sign is fighting words?
That's not a very good analogy to what went on here.
I think, Judge, and I respect Your Honor in that respect, but I'd like to have an opportunity to explain why I think it is similar. There are three factors that are considered by the courts in determining whether something is fighting words. One is whether the words are directed to the hearer's person. Well, that situation will be the same in my hypothetical as it is in this case. You have a sign directed to the public, directed to the street, 5 feet in on the person's yard. Whether or not that is speech directed to the hearer's person would be the same in both the hypothetical situation and in this case. Another factor that's considered by the courts in determining whether speech is fighting words is whether it plays a role in the exposition of ideas. And I think that my hypothetical is really legally indistinguishable from this case in that respect as well. What you had here was a political protest, just like the one in the hypothetical, because Mr. Patel was criticizing people who had gone to the village board to seek the enactment of a new law that would have adversely affected his economic interests. And so I think that when you consider the second issue of whether the speech was played a role in the exposition of ideas, that the hypothetical is quite similar to...
In what sense was this Halloween display political?
Well,
it wasn't the display that encouraged the members of the city council to vote against the proposed ordinance or encouraged other residents in the village to lobby their city council members to vote against the ordinance. It was a Halloween display of tombstones that suggested, implied, depicted the demise in rather unique ways of the neighbors who petitioned the government to pass the ordinance.
Well, it was certainly a criticism of people who had become active politically to try to pass a law that would adversely affect his interests.
But there was nothing in there that made any reference to it. They basically said on the tombstone that the Pertrails wanted their neighbors dead. So, I mean, that's what the tombstones, I mean, the little rhymes, that was what it was all about.
They didn't
say anything about the political side of it.
Well, I think, Judge, I gave the example in my reply brief, and it's really based on the Hustler magazine case where they talked about one of the first political cartoons being a picture of George Washington depicted as an ass. And Judge Rehnquist said we have a tradition in this country of rough-and-tumble, caustic, satirical political speech. And even though...
And I know you raised that Hustler case, but there were some really key differences. For one, when we look at Falwell, he was a public figure. Second, the ad had a message that Falwell was a hypocrite. I mean, saying you want somebody dead doesn't contain any idea or message like that.
Okay.
Does it?
No, but I don't think the sign said that he wanted them dead. I think they were satirical references to what they had done. One of them referred to a speech that John Burka had made at a public meeting, where my client had got up at the meeting and said that, you know, he hadn't been at work for over a year and he couldn't afford to store his motorhome off-site and he was a disabled firefighter. And John Burka said, "Your problems aren't my problem. Your motorhome is my problem." And the sign said, "Old John Burka didn't give a care, so they buried him alive up to his hair." It was a comment on a statement made at a public meeting regarding the enactment of a law, a criticism of someone who took that stand. One other point, if I might, Judge, there's no case law indicating that fighting words should be analyzed differently if a public figure is involved. I'm sure that if Larry Flynt had gone up to the Reverend Falwell on the street and said that your first time was with your mother in a drunken, incestuous rendezvous in an outhouse, that the court would have held that that was fighting words. The reason it wasn't, it was not in a face-to-face confrontation on the street. It was not directed to the hearer's person. If I might, I'd like to talk about those three factors in the context of my Rule 50 motion. It's been the law for a long time that for it to be fighting words, it's got to be speech directed to the hearer's person. It's not enough that the speech be about the person in order for it to be fighting words. If that were the case, and I point this out, you could shut down the Sun-Times and the Tribune editorial board, because we often have very caustic things that are put in an editorial that if you said it to the person on the street, it might be considered to be fighting words. It was in the Cantwell case in 1940 that they said directed to the person of the hearer. In the Chaplinsky case from 1942, the court quoted the New Hampshire Supreme Court as saying the statute as construed does no more than prohibit the face-to-face words plainly likely to cause a breach of the peace. This wasn't a situation where Mr. Patel went up on the and accosted these people on the street. He simply had a display to the public. The signs were 5 feet in on his own property and pointed to the street. He didn't approach the neighbors and hold the signs in their face. So there was no reason to believe that this speech was directed to the hearer's person as opposed to the public in general. On the issue of does it play a role in the expression of ideas, and I really submit to the court that criticism of someone who takes a position on a public issue, I can say, you know, that proponent of this law, I can say he's an idiot. I have a constitutional right to do that. The fact that the signs themselves didn't mention the ordinance is not controlling when everybody in the neighborhood knew that that's why they were posted.
Everybody didn't know about this one related to Jimmy. This one that Petrell explained wasn't meant for little Jimmy, but the kids didn't know it, and they teased him every day on the bus about being a village idiot. Certainly they didn't interpret it that way.
Well, when asked, my client explained to the Lesnar's parents that the sign referred to Jimmy Garbars. The people who talked to the officer told him they both knew that the sign referred to someone's husband. The boy was only 13 years old. He couldn't have been anybody's husband.
But what I'm saying is that you're talking about the public and what the public sees. The kids saw that on the school bus every day. And Jimmy had a learning disability. He was disabled. And they jumped to the conclusion that it was Jimmy. There wasn't.
Well, I mean, if someone doesn't understand what the speech is means or what it's intended to mean, I don't think that it loses its constitutional protection because some teenagers don't understand it. When the people in the neighborhood knew that it referred to James Garbars because it had the date 169 or 1690 at the bottom, and everybody knew that the dates referred to the addresses of the proponents of that law. The other thing I wanted to make clear, the officer knew that this was a political protest because before he arrested Jeffrey Patel, the neighbors told him that they thought Jeffrey Patel was angry with them because they went to the village board complaining about the RV parked in front of his home. And Officer Mason testified that before he arrested Jeff Patel, Jeff told him that he didn't mean the signs as a threat, but that they referred to his neighbors because of the RV ordinance. And Officer Mason testified he had no reason to doubt Mr. Patel in that respect. So before the arrest, Officer Mason knows that Patel is criticizing these people because they're trying to make a law against him. He knew that it was a political protest. And I've cited the Cannon case where people were carrying signs outside an abortion clinic saying it was the killing place. And the court held that the officers were not entitled to qualified immunity and that they had violated the First Amendment rights of the people protesting. In the Cannon case, as a matter of fact, they also cited a case called State versus Meyer where someone had hung a doctor in effigy with bloody hands outside of an abortion clinic, and they said that that played a role in the expression of ideas. Again, if you had a political cartoon, as I said this before, after the Juanita Broderick thing came out, and someone put a political cartoon to indicate President Clinton was a rapist, you have a First Amendment right to do that because it plays a role in the expression of ideas, even if the cartoon doesn't discuss the policies and initiatives favored by the Clinton administration. You have a First Amendment right to criticize the proponent of the law, to call him an idiot, to call him a liar, those speech like that does play a role in the expression of ideas.
Did these signs ultimately lead to some confrontation in the yard between Mason and a neighbor?
They did, and that goes to the third factor only, not to the first two, and you need all three factors for them to be fighting words. But even, I'll just answer your question. I see the white lights on. But as to the third factor, whether the speech is likely to cause an average person to react with violence, the fact that someone reacted with violence, that whether the speech is likely to cause an average person to react with violence is an objective test that the court has to look at the speech and make that determination. Both sides have pointed out. I cited Hurley from the Supreme Court. They cited Connick that this court has a duty to independently evaluate the speech to determine whether it's protected. We don't commit the meaning of the First Amendment to juries.
That's what was done here. Why isn't this reversible on qualified immunity grounds? Because the court didn't make that determination and was required to.
If
we accept that these were not fighting words, according to the Supreme Court's definition of fighting words, the speech was protected, the officer made a reasonable mistake because the officer in the heat of the moment misperceived the law about whether the speech was directed to the person of the hearer and whether it contributed to the marketplace of ideas and whether it would, you know, all the constitutional niceties of the test that courts lay down. Qualified immunity standard leaves ample room for reasonable mistakes, in the words of the Supreme Court. So why shouldn't the judge have simply dismissed this case on qualified immunity grounds?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, the Cannon case is case law that was decided in 1993 that says signs which obliquely refer to people in an abortion clinic as killers is not speech directed to the person. So there was case law already on the books. I'd also like to refer to court. There's a case, Green versus Butler, that I had the privilege of arguing here. And the court points out, I don't need a case on all fours, that officers are presumed to know the law affecting their conduct, and officials can be on notice that their conduct violates established law, even in novel factual circumstances. The salient question is not whether there's a prior case on all fours with the current claim, but whether the state of law at the relevant time gave the defendants fair warning that their treatment of the plaintiff was unconstitutional.
But these lines are notoriously hard for courts to draw, and this is a police officer in the field, caught in the middle between a group of adults behaving badly.
You know, I with respect to the court, I think the lines were clear enough that anyone should know. You can't ban political speech 5 feet in someone's yard just because the neighbors are upset about it. I'm sorry. I'm running out of time. If there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve.
Thank you.
My name is Jim Deano, and I represent Officer Mason in this case. I think the irony of this case and this situation is that the people who were targeted by these tombstones, the neighbors, were actually attacked for exercising their First Amendment right, and that was to petition government because they weren't pleased with the presence of this RV of Mr. Pertel's parked in front of his home for 2 years, blocking the home. So they did the right thing. They petitioned the government. The government offered all sides due process before this ordinance was passed, And the Patels responded with what we believe was this retaliation. And these people, the neighbors who supported the ordinance, were not public persona. They were simply citizens doing what they were told they would have to do if they wanted to change something that was affecting their daily lives, and that was seeing this RV. And there are photographs of the RV in the record. The other thing I from listening, is that I agree that the mayor being an idiot analogy is not accurate in this case, because there was nothing political or nothing of a political protest on these tombstones. They were, at best, malicious name-calling, making references to the gruesome murders of these neighbors, and they didn't refer to the RV or the ordinance or any government officials who actually passed the ordinance.
Well, the political moment had passed, as I understand the chronology here. The ordinance had been passed. The Patels had removed the RV.
Right.
And so while that does not obviously remove his First Amendment rights to comment on what had occurred at City Hall and what his neighbors had done in ganging up on him to get the ordinance passed, it certainly wasn't an effort to influence the political process, because that was already completed.
Right. We think it was retaliation because the political moment, the act had been passed. So there was nothing he could do to affect that process anymore.
He's got a right to engage in retaliatory speech.
Well, if it's not fighting words, and that's what we believe here. And the jury was presented with what we believe was an accurate instruction on what fighting words are. They were presented with the evidence of the case, and we think that the verdict that they reached was proper. And it was a significant issue that was before the jury, the clash of two important safeguards in American life. One is the First Amendment. We all want to have the freedom to express ourselves appropriately. And the other is the right to peaceful existence in your home.
Well, shouldn't the court, rather than the jury, have decided whether the expression was protected by the First Amendment?
Well, I think what the court did, I think that's a question of law. However, I think what the court did was let the analysis of whether these were fighting words go to the jury. But I think as a matter of law, if you look at this court's decision in Gower in 2004, these were fighting words, because you had the same elements. In Gower, you had, I won't be graphic, but the F-U, S-O-B, calling neighbors those terms, clucking like a chicken in front of the neighbor, implying that the chicken was or the neighbor was a chicken, were held by this court to be fighting words. And I think ultimately what we have here is, thankfully for the police officer who has to be in the middle of a situation like this, the protection of qualified immunity. Because I think anything you could say is that reasonable minds could differ in this case as to whether these were fighting words or not. And that's what, you know, the officer there on the ground between these neighbors, and again, watching Mr. Lessner approach Mr. Patel. Mr. Patel testified to a chest butt that occurred. He had to do something to keep the peace. It had been 3 weeks that these tombstones had been up. It was now November 6th. Halloween had come and gone, and Officer Mason made a decision that to preserve the peace, the tombstones would have to come down. And
the fact that the display had been up for so long without incident tends to undermine the aspect of the fighting words test, which pertains to inciting an imminent breach of the peace.
Well, there was an imminent breach of the peace in front of Officer Mason.
Right, and so he could reasonably have been mistaken about the application of the legal standard and all of that for purposes of qualified immunity. But let's assume that these tombstones don't meet the test for fighting words. Back to the question that I asked your opponent earlier and that Judge Williams just posed about why this question was presented to the jury at all, because whether or not this display was fighting words, it goes to the question of whether the speech was protected or not, and that's clearly a legal question for the court. So I'm confused about why the judge thought there was something for the jury here on qualified immunity, because that's always a judge question, not a jury question.
Right, and she didn't present the question of qualified immunity. I think what was presented was the question of First Amendment and fighting words, whether these words were protected by the First Amendment, and then...
That's a legal question.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
Whether they're protected by the First Amendment, that's a legal question.
Right.
If there are underlying evidentiary facts that are in dispute, you know... But
right.
I even question in this circuit whether that goes to the jury. It seems to me pretty clear that we've said qualified immunity questions are for the court.
Right, and we don't disagree with you on that. I think that the court or the district court, we presented the motion for summary judgment on the question of fighting words and on the question of qualified immunity, and that motion was denied on the First Amendment claim but granted on the Fourth Amendment claim. So I don't know why, but it was presented to a jury, and the jury didn't make a decision on qualified immunity but made a decision on fighting words. I think maybe they didn't make a decision on fighting words, but they ultimately concluded that what Officer Mason did not violate the Purtell's First Amendment rights.
The neighbors told the officer that they perceived this display as a threat, and he testified apparently that he was responding to that, and the officer and the neighbors may have misperceived it as a threat, but I'm curious as to why threat doctrine wasn't argued here.
It wasn't argued below. It was presented in the brief here.
Too late.
Yeah, and well, I think, again, we believe there were ample grounds presented below to prevail on a summary judgment, and we did prevail before the jury. So the threat doctrine, again, I think that qualified immunity, before you even get to that, the qualified immunity on the fighting words is what protects Officer Mason here. When he was out there, he was told by neighbors, Mr. Garbar said that the reference to him being 6 feet under was, he thought, a reference to his death. And they were also, they told Officer Mason that they were afraid of Mr. Purtell due to prior incidents in the neighborhood, which I don't think made into the record at trial. But at trial, the jury did hear of the Purtell's intentions and also of the neighbor's anguish. And I think that is what moved Officer Mason to do what he did. He didn't have the time to analyze the vagaries of the fighting words doctrine. What he did was acted, and I think under the evidence here, he acted reasonably. Mrs. Garbars, who was the neighbor who was referred to as a wench with a horrible stench, told him that she felt shame and humiliation. Mr. Garbars, as we've said, told the officer that he felt threatened by these. Mrs. Lesnar explained to the officer the problem with her child, and given that that may have been a misperception by the children on the bus and by Jimmy Lesnar, the fact remains that that information was given to Mr. Purtell when Mrs. Lesnar first approached Mr. Purtell, and there were prior incidents, not physical altercations, but there were incidents where the neighbors called the police, and in one of those, Mrs. Purtell and Mr. Purtell were present, and the Lesnars asked them if the Jimmy sign idiot referred to their son who was having the learning problems, and he said no. But they did explain to him that it was perceived that way, but he chose to leave the sign up knowing that this child was being tormented or ridiculed by his schoolmates.
And there was some tape or something put on that tombstone, and then ultimately it was removed. Was there
Correct.
Any evidence as to why it was removed or whether it was deliberate?
Nobody knows how it was removed. The tape was placed there at the suggestion of an officer who arrived there in mid-October when the neighbors first called the police. And his suggestion was he can leave the signs up as long as we put tape over the names because maybe people seeing the signs won't associate the messages on the signs with the neighbors. I don't know if it worked for a while, but it prevented any physical altercation. But then, by November 6th, the tape was gone, and there was nothing in the record, and we could never find out whether that was intentionally removed or whether just the weather, the moisture, I think it was duct tape.
Duct tape lasts through everything.
Well, maybe then you can infer then that it might have been something more sinister, but I don't know. But ultimately, given the information that Officer Mason had, which included the physical altercation while he was there. And when you talk about imminent physical altercation or imminent violence, he experienced it. He stepped between Mr. Lesnar and Mr. Purtell to break them up. And I think that certainly occurred before the arrest, before his decision was made, that these are not protected by the First Amendment and that they have to come down.
The officer didn't threaten to arrest both of the combatants, did he?
No, he didn't.
Any explanation for that?
Well, I think, I don't know if it's in the record, I think the inference is that the source of all of this was the tombstones, and that this is what the neighbors wanted done to remove the tombstones. He didn't believe that the tombstones were protected by the First Amendment, so starting with what he felt was to be the most offensive and a criminal act, that is disorderly conduct, take the tombstones down, and at least the neighbors will back off, and then it was left to Mr. Bertel to respond in the way that he chose. And finally, we suggest that the jury instruction that was given to the jury was accurate. It related the three elements that were cited by the Supreme Court in Chaplinsky and then recognized and approved by this court in Gower in 2004. So for those reasons, we would ask that you affirm the judgment entered on the jury verdict. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Deano. How much time? You have 1 minute.
I'll be quick. Judge, Your Honor, Judge Sykes, the ordinance had not passed as of the date of the meeting. The ordinance passed according to Exhibit 19 on November 25th. Right. The incident took place on November 6th.
He had already removed the RV, right?
I don't believe that is in the record. But it is in the record that the ordinance didn't pass until a couple of weeks after this took place.
Okay.
Another thing, with respect to qualified immunity, all the comments about the chest butting and everything, that only goes to one of the three things that have to be present for the speech to be not protected. The first thing, that the speech wasn't directed to the hearer's person, I mean, anyone would know that wasn't present. The second thing, that it was had played a role in the expression of ideas, and when the officers told that this is because of a controversy about a law that these people are trying to have passed, I mean, really, anyone would know that plays a role in the exposition of ideas.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.